Good morning. I almost said good Monday morning, but good Tuesday morning. Hope everyone has had a wonderful Memorial Day and enjoyed the good weather and a little bit of sprinkles. Good morning, Dallas. Would you like to update us on where we are here today?
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 134, the A and Gross version. This is the first bill, makes a number of amendments to the public employees retirement system. The bill came out of Senator Byers' Business, Labor and Economic Development Committee. Subsequent to coming out, it was found that there needed to be some technical amendments. Your staff met with staff from the governor's office, Senator Durkler's office, Senator Byers' office, PERS, Administrative Services last week to discuss the technical amendments. Subsequent to that, we were provided with a A36 amendment that I understood was agreed upon to make the amendments. Principally, the amendments were twofold. One was to clear up some ambiguity or kind of a mistake in drafting of provision of placing money in a contingency reserve. The way the bill A and Gross is drafted, it would sequentially require them to place funds, earnings into certain accounts and distribute them that way. And the intent of the committee was not that it be sequential, but that money be placed in the contingency reserve, but with considering distributions of the earnings to Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, as well as the gain loss reserve. So that amendment is included here. There was another amendment that had to do with the pooling. There is the A and Gross version requires basically pooling of all local governments with the state government pool, effective July 1, 2001. This will have a potential impact on state agency contributions, community college contributions, and theirs are expected to increase, the employer contribution rates are expected to increase under that pooling, and the savings and the offset savings would be to local governments. The Dash A36 amendment has that pooling take place not later than July 1, 2003, and it provides for a transition period to allow local governments to pool together and have savings there. If they get to pool their employees, the larger the group, the more stability to the actuarial cost, at least in aggregate. It's the same cost, it's just you don't spread it high for the fluctuations are ameliorated somewhat with the larger the pool of employees. So this would allow pooling, and this is to address issues by a number of local governments who have experienced tremendous swings in their employer contribution rates. For example, a small employer can have one disabled employee can have a tremendous impact on their contribution rates, when you pool them over many thousands of employees, that impact is absorbed throughout the entire the group. So this Dash A36 amendment would allow pooling of all the state, the local governments in a separate pool, and then transitioning that into pooling with employees and state agencies for purposes of employer rate making. So that. Again, that was the result of this meeting that was held last week. We were given the Dash A36 amendments Friday afternoon. You have a packet before you which has the fiscal of the A36 amendment, the staff measure summary on the A and Gross version of the bill, the Dash A36 amendment, and the hand in gross version of the A36 amendment on the affected pages. I believe you also have a copy of the entire bill, which is fairly substantial. The reason it is so long is that it also includes a great number of technical amendments, language cleanup and the like, so it affects a lot of different sections of the statute. The substantive issues, though, are mostly included in the front. Senator Byer is here to discuss the amendments, and then we can go. Dave Hendricks, we have also from Legislative Council, who drafts all legislation for PERS and amendments. So we have people from PERS also looking at this issue.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dallas. Good morning, Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Byer, State Senator, District 15. I'm here today to discuss Senate Bill 134 with you. As you can see from my file, it's been quite a road. This bill, which, as Dallas said, is largely technical amendments and adjustments to the PERS system, there are a few things that Dallas just talked about that are very important to the integrity of the PERS system. And we hashed this out in my business committee for 6 or 7 or 8 work sessions. I don't remember exactly how many. But it was not done in a vacuum, and it was an enormous amount of testimony for and against the bill. And we sent you the AN Growth version, which I think is a good product and does what we want to do. Unfortunately, as staff said, there were some technical amendments that, and if I had the flow chart that would show the differences between what we thought what we wanted and what we actually did, and the 836s or 837s, 840s, and 41s, which I think is what we now apparently need to talk about. There is a later version just this morning. These make the funding of the reserves what we want them to be, and as envisioned by the committee when it came out of the Supplements Committee in the Senate. And that's very important because we want to make sure that we fund all three systems in the PERS system in the correct way, not sequentially like the A and Growth version does, but as the A41s and A40s do. The only difference and the real difference between these two amendments is the effective date of the pooling. As the bill came out of the business committee, it was thought to set up the pooling effective on passage, and my thought being July 1 of this year when the local governments, when the new rates go into effect. The A36s and the A40s give the PERS board up to 2 years to do that. I would like to discuss that issue with you. The policy decision made by the business committee was to make it immediately, because if you don't do it that way, you set up a pool here that for somewhere between 1 month and 2 year time period, which will then have to be tracked for the next 40 or 50 years, as long as there's a living member out there who has been in one of these, what would be now be three pools. First, you've got the individual district, and let's just take any municipality or special district or county. I'm gonna grab the city of McMinnville, just an example. Do you have someone working for them today? They're in a group by themselves. If they joined this local pool as envisioned by the A36s and the A40s, they then would have a time period where they have to be tracked as being part of this pool. Then on the effective date of when they joined with the state pool, they then have three separate systems they have to keep track of for as long as that person is alive and a member of the PERS system, which potentially could be, you know, even 60 or 70 years. Where if you do it as envisioned by the Substance Committee in the Senate, which is you never create that local pool. You go straight from a local unit, the city of McMinnville, to the state pool. It's a more seamless system, one less entity to keep track of for the life of that employee or employees. That is the issue in front of this committee now, with the difference between the A40s and the A41s. I think according to, we get clarification from your committee staff, but I think the fiscal is going to be virtually the same on either one. It may be a little bit higher startup costs and a little bit harder for the PERS staff to get this done right away, but I've been told that they can do this. They may not be able to get the exact rate and what the rate's going to be by July 1 of this year. If we adopt the A41s, they may have to say, let's say that as a local government, you know, the city of McMinnville is now paying, let's say, just pick some numbers at the top of your head, 10%. Okay. Under the local pool, they may go to 9%. And under the A41, they may go to 8.75%. So their local rate has already been set if they join this pool at the 9%. So if we adopt this bill and it comes effective immediately, sometime in the next 2 or 3 months, the PERS board is going to have to notify that employer that your effective rate is actually a quarter of a percent lower, or whatever that amount is. So they may have to give them a credit back for a month or two, however long time, however long it takes them to make that determination. I think it is more important to maybe have that little workload up front and not have to worry about it for the next 40 or 50 years than to always, you know, save a dime now. It may cost you dollars in the future. So that is the difference between the A40s and the A41s. You know, my preference would be, of course, as the bill came down, which is effective immediately. What is probably more important for the health of the PERS system is that we make sure this bill passes in one form or the other. And if the A41s were to jeopardize the bill, I would certainly not support that. I think it is the correct public policy to make, but it's also the correct public policy to get this bill passed and signed by the governor. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions or help you through this. As your staff said, we had about 7 or 8 bills combined into one here, mostly technical stuff. The other substantive change in the PERS system that we did was to change the makeup of the PERS board. Currently, and I've got to go off my memory again, I think it is an 11-member board.
That's correct.
And 2 of which are non-PERS employees. No, 3 of which are non-PERS employees. These changes would make it a majority of that board would be non-PERS employees. So 6 of the 11 would be non-PERS people, and 3 of those 6 would have to have expertise in pensions or pension management or investments to try to bring more credibility to decisions made by the board so that they're and to get rid of the potential conflict of interest that is, exists now between the existing board. So that is the that and the funding of the contingency funds are the 2 substantive changes in 134.
Thank you, Senator Byer. Senator Dukes.
You have to bear with me here. Every year I get put on a committee that all of a sudden deals with PERS, and I have to go through this very difficult process to get back in and remember any of this, because as soon as it's over, I delete it from my memory very quickly. An issue I never wanted to deal with. PERS was set up a long time ago for public employees, for the workers, the folks who show up every day and do whatever they do in their jobs. I was struck, you said it would be a conflict of interest to have a majority of the board public employees. I mean, it's their system. It's not our system. I mean, except that we're PERS members. How is that a conflict? I'm going to assume that some of them, like folks who work in Department of Revenue and things like that, have particular talents that could be helpful. So we certainly have public employee, city auditors and things all over the state. Why is it a conflict of interest?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, I guess the reason is that the taxpayers of the state fund system is not funded by only the employees. It's funded by the taxpayers of the state of Oregon, both state and local governments. And the taxpayers of the state of Oregon and the PERS board is in charge of that asset, and the asset of the thousands of people who are members of PERS, but also the thousands or millions of people who are paying for the system. So the conflict of interest, and whether it's real or perceived, that is the big question. That's why it's a controversial change, to change from a majority of the members being PERS members to a majority of members being non-PERS members. That's not without controversy. I hope I didn't portray that it was.
Okay. Well, I was curious as to what, and honestly, I haven't heard much about this bill, so what the other side was. I clearly, we don't get this many people for any bill, so obviously there's a little controversy.
We have this many people, about twice as many people every time we hear this.
Maybe we'll get to hear from that later.
But the issue is that and both sides will tell you there is no conflict or there is a conflict, and it's evident by the fact that the PERS system, the PERS board, is being sued by both employer groups and employee groups for how they manage the money. So obviously there's perceived from both sides that they're not doing it properly. And the thought by our committee, my committee, was that if we can separate the system somewhat from the people who are using it and get some expertise in the system, and that would be people who have experience in this managing money and running pension systems. It would help to, and whether it's just real or perceived or what, in this business, as you know, Senator Dukes, you know, perception is reality. So if it's perceived there is a conflict in the FERS board, there probably is, or at least in the eyes of the public, there probably is.
Well, I don't think the public knows much about it. You said that it's a conflict because the taxpayers are paying for it. Doesn't that beg the question of when taxpayer money becomes non-taxpayer money? I mean, it's sort of like the point at which they hand me my check. I think the courts have decided it's my money and it's not taxpayer money. Since all of the PERS contributions are wrapped up in a benefits package that the courts have also determined is equivalent to compensation. I mean, at the point at which it goes in, it stops being taxpayer money. It becomes individual contributions. I guess I'm still struggling. I don't see the clear conflict, and that may be because I deliberately don't get involved with PERS more than every other year. But it just seems to me that the ones that systems that run well are usually run by people who care very much about them, and I can't imagine who would care more than people whose retirement, whose future is tied up in that.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, I understand what you're saying, but the way the system is run is that how the money is distributed, the earnings on the fund is distributed, very greatly affects the rate that the government, local, state, local, and K-12 governments pay to fund the system. And that is where the rub comes in. It's because the earnings on the fund can be distributed in many different ways. And for example, we have a contingency reserve set up in the system that the PERS board has never funded. And that's this bill, as drafted, will force them to fund the contingency reserve. That was a decision made by the board, because if you take money, the earnings, and put it in the contingency reserve, rather than give it to the employees, it then drives the cost up in the system to the public employers. That is one, the essence of one of the lawsuits filed against the board. They've never funded an existing reserve.
So the perspective that this bill comes to us with then is that it is important in the PERS system to reduce the cost of the employer? I assume without harming the employee.
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes. Yes, you've got it mostly right. We cannot harm the employees. I mean, they're the contract. This bill,
sure you can. Every time you decide to take what should be my earnings and reinvest them in something, you've already injured me. So, but go ahead.
Where this bill comes from is that to make the system financially stable without breaking the taxpayers. That's the idea.
I thought we were one of the most stable systems in the nation.
We have, since the start of session, Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, the PERS own actuarial firm or contract firm that has been hired shows the fund somewhere between $0 and $14 billion in the hole.
But aren't we rated in New York? Aren't we rated as one of the most stable funds in the nation?
I don't know.
That's what I've always been told. Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Madam Chair, a question for a good senator. Senator Beyer, I apologize, I had to get out of the room for a moment, but as we look at the local government employees joining a state pool, I recognize that right now local governments are pretty much on their own, whether a special district or a county or a city. By joining in with a state or a common pool for all PERS employees, there would be an increase, a commensurate decrease for perhaps some of the local governmental entities, and an increase in the state cost, the state side of the PERS contribution. Do we know the amounts of the offset from the one to the other?
The fiscal we had when it left the business committee, Representative Butler, was a cost of about $10 million that would be shifted from local governments to state governments. Of that, about 45% of that would be general fund, So you got about 4.5 million in that shift from local governments to state government. That was discussed at great length in the business committee, and it was decided that because the 1995 changes made by the legislature dealing with the federal retirees and the cost that we shifted from state government to local governments at that time, which was in excess of $100 million, we thought this was probably a pretty small price to pay to bring those local governments in, get them some stability in their rates, because currently these local governments, I mean, if they've got one or two or five or ten employees, their rates can fluctuate wildly, and this will bring them stability. And it's important to point out there will not be one pool by this bill. There will be still be two pools. K through 12 would still be a separate pool entity, all K through 12 districts in the state. And then you would have another pool entity, which would be the state government, the community colleges, and all local governments who choose to join the pool. This becomes voluntarily. They don't have to join the pool if they don't want to.
Oh, just one follow-up, and then I'll go to Representative Hayden, and then Representative Jones.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make absolutely certain that when we talk about the fund shift back as a result of the federal retirees and the original Davis versus Michigan and the federal Supreme Court's issues that came out after that, in that process, it's my understanding that there's some rather significant litigation that's pending. Does this litigation go away as a result of Senate Bill 134 as presently engrossed?
Madam Chair, Senator Representative Butler, the litigation filed against the PERS board, is that?
All forms of litigation where the state may be interfled and the PERS may be interfled in it.
Okay. Representative Butler, we were very careful in the draft in 134 that anything we do in this bill will not affect any pending lawsuits out there. Those lawsuits will still be there, will still go forward. And we were very careful to make sure that we didn't do anything pro or con to influence the decision of those lawsuits, because we felt that in the system, that anytime you change the system, you have to create a firewall from one from the old system to the new system. So any liabilities that a local government currently has affecting their rates will not go forward into the state pool if they so choose to join the pool. Those liabilities will have to be separated and held, and they have to then come into the state pool as a clean bill of slate. That is one of the reasons why I don't like the idea of creating a separate local pool for a short period of time, because you have the same problem then, that any liabilities incurred by that local pool could not be moved into the state pool. They have to be held separately and kept track of separately, and then you start over again. So you have a clean break every time you change the system. So we were very careful to not to influence the decisions or those lawsuits that are currently pending to the system.
Senator Hayden and then Representative Johnson.
Yes, Senator, maybe you've already explained it and I missed it, but in any system there are winners and losers. You've explained how rates would drop for some local governments, but rates must rise for some local governments to compensate for that, or some third party must make up the difference. Now, I think I just heard you say that for those whose rates would increase, they can opt out. They don't have to join, which means that only systems whose rates are going to decrease are going to join. And who pays in that case? As long as we don't have winners and losers, as we have only losers join the system, or who are losing now and will win under the new system, how do we make up the economic difference there? Is it the taxpayers or?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, yes, you are mostly right that in the pooling that is done by rule for the PERS system, the local pool, you are right that only employing units who are going to see their rates lowered, for the most part, elected to join that local pool. What we have found, and someone from the PERS system can give us the exact number, but once this bill passed out of the business committee, more and more local governments even ones that would see their rates rise slightly by joining the state pool have indicated an interest in joining this state pool because of the stability, long-term predictability, which is very important. As any employing unit, you would know running a business yourself that it's, even if your costs are 0.25% higher, you'd like that versus a cost that could widely fluctuate from year to year, and especially as a tax-paying unit, where you get your money through local taxes, and you have no ability to raise those local taxes, you know, whether it be property taxes or however you're funded as a local government. So we have seen a lot of local governments choosing, even though it would slightly raise their rates, to elect to join this larger pool. So yes, there will be winners and losers, and any time you have a higher cost local government join the state pool, that is what's going to raise the cost of the state pool slightly. But you've got such a small amount of people coming in to such a large pool that it is, as your staff said, it can just, you know, you don't fluctuate the rate of the state pool very much by bringing a few people in it.
Madam Chair, but we don't decrease benefits to the retired employees under the system. We socialize a slight increase across the entire employer system to compensate for that.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Habe, that's correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I was interested in listening to your composition, your proposed composition of the new board, with the requirement that board members have expertise in investment. To what degree right now is the PERS board making independent investment decisions?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, the investment decisions are made by the Oregon Investment Council. So, and the members of the council, and I don't remember the makeup of them off the top of my head, but they are a wide range of people around the state, and they do have investment expertise. And I would have to look and see exactly what the language says, but the three members we said have to be, the three new members have to have expertise in pension management, and I think it was investment. I'm not sure about that, but it clearly was pension management.
Questions of Senator Beyer? If not, thank you, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate very much you guys taking this up, and as I said, it's very important this bill passes. I would personally prefer the A41 amendments, but if this committee sees fit to adopt A40, yes, we can live with that.
And the A41s will be all inclusive with what was in the A36, is that correct?
The A41s are equivalent to what the A37.
The A40s
are roughly equivalent to the A36.
Thank you. Senator,
I thought you said you preferred the bill as it came out of committee. Did I misunderstand?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, the A40, make sure I got the right one now, the A41s are fix the technical problems that came with the bill, but leave the effective date as it came from.
Okay, so it's the bill with the technical things.
The A40s fix the same technical problems and put a effective date of no later than July 1st, 2003. That is the difference between the A41s and A40s. And as it came out of committee, we chose the effective on passage July 1, whenever it was passed. So that would be my preference.
Thank you, Senator. Next, I'd like to have Dave Hendricks come up.
The question of legislative fiscal office, Madam Chair, if this bill with the A41s went into effect with the passage, then we've got a rebalance issue almost immediately, do we not, Gala?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, members of the committee, potentially they could redo the rates and kick them in immediately. I don't think that would be acceptable because most state budgets have passed. The board has historically provided a transition period or a time lag for rate increases. when it knew that rates were going to increase for employers, it would allow them the time to incorporate those new rates into their budgets before they would take effect. For rate decreases, they would allow state all employers to take advantage of the decrease immediately. So going on past history, I would suggest that the board might defer and make up the increase in the cost in the 03-05 biennium rather than go back and change the rates that we've been operating under for all state agency budgets.
Okay. Following up with Dallas's suggestion about setting up a system where the rates would kick in not the biennium that will occur July 1 of this year, but 2 years and 3 weeks from now, or 2 years and a month from now. What would be the effect of deleting the emergency clause and then stipulating that that's when the rates would go into effect?
Do you want to respond to that, Dallas, or do you want to?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, members of the committee, I had thought about that myself earlier. What it would do is it just tell the board that no rate increases to state agencies shall take effect until July 1, 2003. But because of the A36 language, which allows the transition period, which really then would effectively change the rates in the 03-05 biennium, I didn't think it was necessary.
Madam Chair, perhaps as we are this legislature and budgeting for the next biennium, perhaps the rates would go into effect June 30 of 2003.
Dave, would you like to introduce yourself for the record and help us with this question we're pondering?
Barry Clarno, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. I believe that PERS has a date that they use every year, and I can't remember. Is it in November?
Mr. Bailey, the Deputy for PERS, would you like to come up and see if you could assist with this as well? Introduce yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm David Bailey, PERS Deputy Director. If I understood the question correctly, I think the question was that we would actually merge the state with the local governments but delay the effective date of the rates until 2003. Was that the...
That's the question, Representative
Hayden. Well... The problem was, Madam Chair, if the increase is to be allowed, and as we're discussing the date that it will be, the mindset sort of seems to be that perhaps we're moving that direction. If the increase is to be allowed or the change, then the problem that the committee faces is if there is a $10 million impact, or was that $10 million? Where does the money come from? Because the money is pretty well used up biennium. So do you start the rates in this coming biennium that we're budgeting for when we don't have the $10 million, or do you start it in the following one? And if you start it in the following one, do we have the authority to do that? That's my question.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, if we adopt the A40 amendment, the rates would start on July 1, 2003, and the cost to the state would begin on that date. So there would be no fiscal impact in this biennium.
Madam Chair, and why would they start? That's some time from now. Why would they start on July 1, 2003?
Because we would base the. Let me just look at my notes here. We would base the actual beginning of the pool where we, and the costs are based on when we start commingling the assets and the experience of the employers and looking at that, and that would be 1-1 of 02. And really, we're always looking to pay for experience that has already occurred. And so the rates are always starting at a later date than the costs have been incurred. So I don't know if that helps or not.
Well, I don't understand why it works, but the timing seems to be good as you describe it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Dave, do you, would you like to go ahead from Legislative Council's perspective and give us any information you would like to share with us this morning? Or?
Chair Carno, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks again. The amendments that you have before them, I think that Senator Byers done a good job of describing them to you. The changes primarily relate to the specific language we used on the contingency fund on how it was going to be funded. There was some concern after the Angross bill passed because the Angross bill had laid out a particular sequence for the manner in which reserves, how the earnings on the PERS fund were going to be spent. And after looking at it, after the passage of the bill, there was some concerns raised about whether or not it was going to accurately reflect the way in which the earnings were in fact expended and change things that were not intended to be changed. So the A40s and the A41s basically go back in and make it clear that only the essential changes are made, specifically a requirement of a 5% of earnings be dedicated to the contingency fund, which is a fund which appears in the bill, has some new purposes, and that those get paid in any year in which there's earnings above the assumed interest rate, which is now 8%. So in any year which you got over 8%, you will have to fund that 5%. And then the remaining principal changes relate specifically to this issue that you've been discussing relating to pooling. The reason you have an 840 and an 841 versus a 36 and 37 is that Keith Putman, the administrator for Senate Business, who knows this issue now probably far better than he wants to, was looking at them on Friday, and these have been moving very quickly. Saw one little technical issue about the timing on the pooling, and I thought it would be best to clarify it to make sure there was no issue, and so we did a quick change, and the only change is related to calculating the liabilities of the employers. That's going to be important in this pooling because, as it's already been described to you, when the local governments come into these pools, they can't bring along their former liabilities. PERS has to draw a line and say, all your liabilities you had from before when you were pooled, you're still going to be paying the old rate on those. You know, if you had a 15% rate, you're still going to be paying 15% on those liabilities. All liabilities that you incur hereafter will be pooled along with the state. And so you will get a lower rate for those liabilities, assuming that that your rate would have been higher otherwise, except for the pooling. And the one little issue there was the 836 and 837s had talked about the date of election, and we wanted to make it sure it was the date the election became effective. So that was the only change between the 36, 37s, and the 40 and the 41s.
Why is there an assumed rate of 8%? What is the actual history of the PERS fund recently? And to put it in context, my defined benefit assumes a 6% return, but it was really -2. So how can we assume an 8% return? I understand it's an assumption, but why do we pick that number?
Chair Carno, that might be a better question here for Mr. Bailey. They set it based on, I know they do it based on a backward look, I believe, of 30 years. But.
And I think the feds pick a 6% rate, at least in the programs I'm familiar with.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the 8% is based, it's a recommendation made by the actuary, and we review that every time we do an actuarial valuation. We do look at, as far back as 50 years, at the history of the market and the earnings of the fund, but we also look at a variety of information in the field as far as what earnings will be projected to be in the future. We also look at the assumptions that are made by other systems around the country, and we set the earnings rate accordingly. And 8% is really right in the middle of what other public sector retirement systems assume. I can't tell you what the average earnings of the fund have been since 1946, but actually 8% has probably been low for the last 20 years. One of the issues we have with the assumption is that by statute, the guaranteed crediting, annual crediting to Tier 1 member accounts has to be the same as the assumption, as the assumed rate. So if you increase the assumed rate, you would be increasing the guarantee and having some effect on lowering cost to employ. There would be two competing effects there. And it's hard to say how they would play out, but there's a linkage between those two numbers.
I'm sure. Well, if you assume 8% and you make 10%, this is good. If you assume 8% and you make 3%, this is not so good for the taxpayer. And you say that 8% is common in the public sector. Is it common in the private sector, or is it a little rich? And if you don't know what the average is for the last 50 years, and I don't, what is it for this year?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I'm sorry I can't speak to what the private sector assumptions are.
What's the PERS?
For the year 2000, we earned in Tier 1, I think, 0.64%, so less than 1%. And in the variable fund, we lost 3.5, something like that.
So hard to say. Thank you.
Representative Johnson, did I miss you? Did you have a question?
No.
Any further questions or comments? Mr. Bailey, do you have anything else you'd like to share with us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just the one point that we do have about 203 local governments that have elected voluntarily to join the local government rate pool. Of those 203, about 67% would see lower rates on July 1 of this year, and some significantly lower. So we'd like to see that go into effect. I think that those folks would like to see that go into effect also. 33% will see higher rates. The reason they are joining, even though they would see higher rates, is that they appreciate the insurance value of joining the pool and want the stability that a pool would provide going forward. There was one other issue which Senator Beyer mentioned, and I think there's probably a miscommunication based on our inability to communicate exactly how the pools would work, but we don't see any significant ongoing cost or administrative difficulty by forming the local government rate pool and later allowing the locals to move into the with the state and dissolving the local government rate pool at that time. That's a mathematical calculation that we can do, and I'm sorry if we miscommunicated about that in the past.
Any further questions or discussions? Senator Dukes.
For some time, I've been told the PERS system is one of the best funded in the nation. Is that still the case?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes.
It made it sound like you guys were about to fall apart, so I just checked.
There has been some confusion about that, and the fact is that we are very well funded. When you look at the funding of a system, what you want to be is 100% funded, which basically just means that you're putting the seed money away that you need to put away to accrue the amount of money you need to pay benefits. And today we have 98%. 2 years ago we had 95%. So we've improved over the last couple of years, and we are very well funded. The confusion has come about because we've done some projections to look at the next 40 years. And we've done that because Tier 1 is going to go away. It's the last person's club. And when the last Tier 1 member leaves, we'd like to know what the potential status of the fund would be. And that's where you get these potential projections of dire underfunding. But we've also run some projections where we might have a surplus. So it depends on what crediting decisions are made over the next 40 years to determine what the status of the fund will be, and of course the earnings of the fund and those sorts of things. But really doing the projections that we've done and seeing what the potential consequences could be is going to be very helpful to future boards in making decisions about how to credit the earnings of the fund. But as of today, we're extremely well funded.
General,
now that's not true of every employer.
Yes. And we're only talking the PERS fund.
Yes.
Can those decisions be made within the present framework of PERS?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, certainly.
You said that there are a lot of, I assume smaller, maybe not, and a lot of local governments that would join and would have lower rates. And I'm trying to pick up on what little I understood of what Representative Hayden was asking. They were very good questions. It just takes me a while to wade back into this. There are going to be some losers, and you indicated that they would likely sign up anyway because they want the stability. What if some of them don't? Are we, I mean, do we know exactly what's going to happen if we go forward with this? If some of them don't come along, if times aren't real good, paying higher rates could be a problem for them. Who picks up that slack?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, unfortunately, we don't know what will happen. That's why we do the actuarial evaluations, and it's very complicated to project what future costs are going to be. However, we do know that when we credit interest every year, say we earn 10%, we're going to credit 10% to the employees and 10% to the employers, and all the reserves get the same percentage. But with the money match system, if an employer has significantly fewer dollars than their employees do, they're earning 10% on a smaller asset base.
Okay.
So there would be a tendency for them to fall behind. And the greater the disparity between the assets of the employer and the assets of their employees, the greater risk they are at today. And that's one of the main reasons why we wanted to form the local government rate pool and do it as quickly as possible, because the sooner those severely underfunded employers can join a pool, the sooner we can freeze that liability as a dollar amount. And this is essentially what will happen in the local government rate pool and the merger with the state pool, is that the transition liability, as we call it, is frozen as a dollar amount, and then it's paid back to the system over 27 years through a higher rate, but it won't grow, and that's the real benefit to underfunded employers of joining the pool. If they don't join the pool, they continue to be at risk that their underfunded status could increase.
The bill does address, Chair Butler, Senator Dukes, it does address some of the issues that drove some of the problems that local governments are currently having, specifically things like members who are invested in the variable annuity account, whereas the employer was locked in at the more conservative investments. And so the bill does address some of those things that tended to drive up some of those rates for some of the local governments, but it can't address all of them. Their individual experience will still dictate to some degree things like the five employee local government who has one or two go out on disability. That is always going to be a scenario where if they're not in the pool, they're going to be looking at a huge increase in their contribution rates.
Is it too simple to say that coming in there are winners and losers, and if the winners come in and the losers don't, the system itself will pick up the difference?
Mr. Chair,
tell me that, go ahead.
I think the way that the pool has been put together for local governments and the state merger would be the same, is very well thought out, and we have to give credit to our employers that helped us with that and our actuary and many people. But essentially, when the employers that are joining who are going to see lower rates are employers that are in surplus. And it's the same issue as the folks with a liability. They have a transition surplus, which they get to amortize over 27 years through a lower rate. And that has encouraged many overfunded employers to join with the underfunded employers. And actually, in the local government rate pool, we're showing about $123 million surplus. So the local pool is extremely well funded. And I guess it's fair to say there's winners and losers as far as rates go, but that's a choice that they've made themselves. And that they're just looking at today's rate. The ones that have joined and are going to see higher rates are taking a longer-term view, which is really how we've encouraged employers to look at it, because rates tend to fluctuate, and reducing the volatility is really the reason to join the pool.
Last interim on the audit committee, I remember being told as we were looking over the PERS computer system that every time the legislature made a change, we allowed some particular group to buy back into the system, that all of that had to be hand processed because the computer wasn't capable of doing those kinds of things. In other words, we seem to have programmed that computer to the maximum of its abilities. What does a bill like this do to the computer system? I mean, we've put you on hold. You've got like a dollar or something in your computer system, and you're going to run through five committees, I think, before you get approval to do anything new on that system. So we're not exactly moving real fast down the track to get that replaced. What does this do to that system?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, I wasn't told I'd have to talk about the computer system.
Every time we talk about that, I worry that I'm not going to have a retirement system.
But this really doesn't have a significant effect on the current computer system.
You can program in all those
people? Well, what we do is we provide data to the actuary on our members. And it's not the easiest thing, but this really doesn't change that. We'll still be providing the same kind of data. Then the actuary will combine it for the pool rather than analyzing it separately for each employer. So this really doesn't have any significant impact. Pooling has no significant impact on our computer system.
You're not picking up new employees or anything like that?
No, ma'am.
Representative Butler?
Madam Chair, in as much as we are in work session,
Well, Dallas thinks I opened just a public.
Just public?
So I'll
okay.
Open the work session.
Thank you. Madam Chair, the preference of Representative Senator Byers, Senator Byer, was to incorporate the A41 amendment, which would basically move forward with the changes immediately. And I would move the A41 amendments to Senate Bill 134.
Thank you, Representative Butler. And I would just like to say that I did have several requests about further testimony. Representative Byer mentioned in his testimony that he had six or seven work sessions on the bill. And it's my understanding that leadership has been involved and the Dash A41 amendments are acceptable and worked on very thoroughly by a group of folks. Representative Hayden?
Chair, I'm perfectly prepared to vote on this at this time, but with other people that wanted to testify in public session, the room seems very full.
Well, Representative Hayden, do you want to stay here during session?
Well, Madam Chair, in relation to your comments, some of the leadership's been involved, I should say, and I think that further testimony is desirable on this issue, and I think we should continue to let people testify and air their concerns in the bill.
I think, Representative Gardner, I certainly appreciate your comments and appreciate your leadership. I guess I'm extremely concerned about the fact that we have technical amendments before us, but that's all we have to deal with in this committee. We're not a substantive committee, and we're not a committee that's going to take up the whole bill, and I've had requests that people would like to talk on the whole bill, and 6 or 7 work sessions in the Senate certainly would have been ample time for people to hear their concerns on this, and I just feel like we should move ahead with the bill.
However, Madam Chair, it has not been through a substantive committee on the House side, and this is a rather complex and very long impacting measure that certainly could have severe litigation coming out of it, and not giving it a hearing either in this committee or in another substantive committee in the House seems to be awful fast-tracking this one.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Dallas, would you like to comment on that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, this hasn't come to the House yet. It's been solely on the Senate side. If we move it out of subcommittee, then it goes to Ways and Means full, tentatively scheduled for this Friday, and if after full, it goes then to the Senate floor, at which time it will be subject to more debate, and then to the, if passed there, it will go to the House, and then I'd leave the Senate to the substitute committee. I can't promise, but
that would be my understanding, but I can't promise either. But that's what I assumed would happen. Senator Duke said that.
Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. We don't know that it'll be passed even on the Senate, so that's a good point. May die there.
Senator Duke?
Just a couple of things. Every session that I've been on Ways and Means, I've come down wanting to believe that we don't do substantive. We do substantive. So to suddenly say that we don't do substantive in Ways and Means, even this session, I've sat on subcommittees that are doing substantive changes, and sometimes it's necessary to do that. I have been told that bills, especially this close to the end, that come out of Ways and Means on one side will just get a sign off from the other side. So my guess is that the chances of this going through a substantive committee on the House side is very weak. And my third point is, I think it's just plain rude to have that many people sitting in an audience whose futures, obviously this is fairly critical to them, and not let them speak, especially if they've had the chance in one Senate committee and that's the only chance they're ever going to get. We're not going home tomorrow. I think we probably got the time to do it.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Hannan.
Out of courtesy, I'll will give a vote to amend the bill, and the only motion I will support is one that sends this bill to the co-chairs, not to the full Ways and Means Committee. I'm opposed to this bill. I have no intention of allowing it out of Ways and Means.
With that comment,
My motion stands, Madam Chair, to incorporate the A41 amendments.
You heard the motion before us. Any further discussion? Any objection? Record Representative Johnson, Representative Gardner, Representative Witt as objections, and Senator Duke's objection.
I don't think so. That's not my part of the bill.
Okay.
A whole lot of the rest of the bill I'd like to do something with.
Okay. If not, the amendment stand as moved. Senator or Representative Butler.
I noticed that. That was not a change.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Witt, you were a no vote. Okay, the motion died.
Okay. Madam Chair, then I would move that we pass Senate Bill 134 as A and Gross from the Senate, and I believe that's through the 36-36 amendments, to the co-chairs.
Heard the motion before us. Any discussion?
No amendments, correct?
No amendments. Just as A and Gross.
Any objection? Senator Dukes objects. Senator Representative Johnson, Representative Gardner, and Representative Witt object. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 134 and open a public hearing on House Bill 5025.
rush out and close the door. Barred from the outside.
Oh, sorry, I'm sorry. You want a chair? No, seriously.